Hi, everyone. Thank you for joining us this week in the Dorsey Wright Podcast. Today is December 6th. My name is Ben Jones. I'm here with Steve Raymond, head of our mutual fund research, and fund research, I should say.
We're going to promotion.
I like it. I gave him that promotion just now.
There you go.
But no, Steve has definitely pioneered a lot of our research involving ETFs and mutual funds, especially as it relates to our fund scores, and developed a lot of our fund score base models, which I think are fascinating and provide some great solutions for advisors and investors anywhere using the fund score system on the Dorsey Research platform. So for today's podcast, I think it would be helpful to talk models, be it our fund score method models or some of the other concepts that we've talked about with advisors and with some of our ETF clients.
Yeah, Ben. In fact, I remember you had a conversation very recently with some important folks, kind of breaking into the idea of just basic models in general. What methods are available, or what I thought was interesting is the concept of what should go in a model. From an inventory point of view, I get a lot of questions, and including a lot since December opened up, concerning this idea that some models might do better than others, and the principal question might be why. Mm-hmm. And my first answer, let's say, is probably going to come back to that inventory.
Yep.
The inventory is highly indicative of the result, believe it or not, as primitive as that sounds. And sometimes you don't know, like, when the inventory will do much better or less well than expected. A case in point would be just a reference back to a couple models that we work on the FSM side, is that the T. Rowe Price model is doing very, very, very well.
Mm-hmm.
I think according to expectation as well, meaning that we believe they're supposed to do well. Maybe the Vanguard model doing less well, mm-hmm. maybe less well than expected. And it tends to be, as you examine these issues, it comes back to the kind of how that inventory was reacting with each other in a given particular year. But I think the broader point, as I heard you speaking to some other folks, Ben, is what are my options? Like, for example, should I just put all the inventory from a single house in to a model? Which I might refer to as a single provider, mm-hmm. Universe. Should I venture to have different, strong players in amongst different providers and put them together?
Right.
So that you might call that a multi-provider kind of, solution. So what do you think, Ben, maybe we can talk about why would one do one or the other?
Okay, let's do it. So it's kind of lifting up the hood, so to speak, and kind of seeing kind of the guts and what really is driving, these models. And it's all typically inventory dependent. So for those of you who may not be familiar with our research platform, we offer, 40 to 50 plus, guided models that are available, online. And these are what they call, in the industry, kind of paper guided models that, you, the advisor, are able to follow based on the signals that we generate. The majority of our models are relative strength based, and so we use relative strength to essentially, select, our funds, our investments, our opportunities. Idea being, we want to own what is strong, what is favored, what is outperforming relative to those other assets. And so, when we look at the models that are available on the research platform, majority of them are built with a specific provider in mind, right? And so, what we do is that we work with a provider to develop a model that meets a certain objective. Let's say we want a sector rotation model. The goal being, we want to rotate among the sectors to identify the strongest one. So we pull from their sector lineup, right? And that's typically what you see for our models on our system. We work with the likes of First Trust and Deutsche Bank and PowerShares. But I think what's unique, though, about the research platform is that we give you, the subscriber, the ability to create your own models, right? And mm-hmm. I think that's where the question comes into play about, mm-hmm. What is in the inventory? Mm-hmm. Because I think what we have seen is that you brought up a good point, is that, there's a difference in performance between some of the models that might use the same methodology, and it's solely based off of the inventory, right?
Right.
What sectors are in that inventory can cause major differences in performance and performance differentials. A good example being, looking at our sector model lineup, is that, because of, you know, some models are limited to the certain, you know, sector ETFs that are available, you know, they might not be able to participate in a certain subsector.
Right.
Right. And so when you have a subsector, let's say, you know, like gold or steel or biotechnology participating, if it's in that inventory, the models typically adapt and allocate to those areas.
Mm-hmm.
But if that inventory doesn't have the capacity to allocate to that area, you know, it might lag, or it might participate from a broad sector standpoint, but not through the pure 100% subsector. So inventory management is crucial. I think, in my opinion, it's probably one of the most important things about model construction, and one of the most important things about what we do here at Dorsey, right, is that, you know, we make sure that the inventories are developed in such a way that can, you know, capture a wider range of trends and opportunities working with certain ETF providers. And then, you know, what's important too is that, you know, having the tools in the system where you can build your own models, you can curate and develop your own, you know, model inventory. And that's where I think, you know, the Matrix tool is such a powerful tool, because you can, you know, create your own ranking and ultimately your own model, you know, pulling from a different set of ETFs or a different set of mutual funds from a different set of families, as well as different, you know, exposure types.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it will lead back to this question. I often, when I, you know, back in the maybe a start of my understanding of this business, way back whenever that was, I tended to look for superstars amongst different families. It might have been the decade that, you know, that was, you know, you're talking about the 90s, and kind of that's what push one is. Let's find the best of the best wherever they can be found. You know, I think a wise person sat me down somewhere in the 2000s and brought up a point I actually never considered, which was, hey, you know, you don't have to always approach it that way. I mean, there are some other options, and one of them would be, you know, pick a particular shop that has a particular culture and use all the investments that they bring to the table. It tends to bring a methodical approach to why those portfolios were constructed. In other words, you're getting the same shop putting different, let's say, mutual funds or ETFs on the table, and they're on purpose. They're not making them all the same.
Right.
You know, in other words, the culture is involved in making sure that these are run in a distinct way. And I think that was actually, you know, that did impress me. I think that sometimes now, my bias is, you know, a little 50-50. I do like to look at, you know, single shop providers, you know, and what they offer as a culture. A couple come to mind right off the table when I say that, or maybe three. American Funds, mm-hmm. You know, they have a culture that is just unique, I think. And so when you pick funds within American Funds, their guidance, their methodology is built into, you know, why that fund's there. And so if someone believes in that shop culture and the way they guide and team manage their things, and you think that's a value, then you definitely want to stick mm-hmm. with a provider, because if you move to another provider and mix that with, let's say, American Funds, you're getting different cultures,
yeah,
and it may be different to predict, harder to predict how the inventory, the resulting inventory, would behave. So, you know, think about that. The idea of the single provider, you know, being able to give you a great model that's guided with that culture. PIMCO comes to mind. You know, they have a way of doing things, and although some of their funds, some people may say, well, they might be similar. I don't think they are similar. I think that, you know, they've got a culture that here's what you get. You get, you know, expertise in this way, and, you know, so if I use PIMCO, then I get that. If I mix PIMCO in with too many other people, I might lose that I was actually searching for. So, you know, that's an idea.
You've done some testing, you know, with some of the PIMCO funds using relative strength. And how have you seen kind of a PIMCO, you know, relative strength model work with, you know, some of the other models on our platform? You know, for example, taking the PIMCO concept, would you pair it with the likes of an American Funds FSM model? Or would you take PIMCO, which is a really unique brand, unique culture, unique methodology, with a more kind of, you know, passive index approach like with Vanguard?
Yeah. No, I think that's a great question. Maybe I'll step back and say that, you know, the PIMCO effort's still underway. I know that PIMCO might have an interest in what we do, but I think in this case, on the mutual fund side, I don't know what their interest is on that. But, you know, PIMCO as a shop actually puts together a fantastic all-asset kind of collection. And what's, I think, been, you know, the holdup for me is, as well, people, do they really want the fixed income side of that collection? Do they want the all combined? Do they want to just go with equity? And a lot of feedback I get is that they, you know, people might like to see a fixed income, you know, kind of product there. But I keep reminding them that they do really good in equity. So, you know, maybe the tension is we might have to have two models. One's all asset, which means anything goes, and the other is fixed income. I think they do well as a model to themselves, let's say. And then in another sleeve, you have American funds. I tend to probably say that that would be the proper way we should go, and of course we would advocate that you should go that way, is to not have in the same model the PIMCO and American funds slugging it out, but another sleeve, you know, X percent American funds, X percent PIMCO, and let each of those shops do what they do.
Right.
Because what happens when you can flag inventories in the same model is that the unpredictable nature of one fund stealing the score from another, who knew it would happen or could happen. In other words, you're actually detracting from probably what each of those shops are doing independently very well. You know, and you could keep on going with the sentiment. Like, for example, T. Rowe Price is good at I think, several things. One thing for sure is focus. Mm-hmm. They provide focused, active, managed investing like no one else I know now.
Which has been great this year.
And every decade or two, there's a leader in the active managers. Janus used to be a great active manager decades and decades ago. Don't take that as an insult. Maybe a decade ago, you know, or more. But and then T. Rowe has been filling in that space for some 15 years. But those are some considerations. You know, how do you find the components of the model? Which is why I was interested in your conversation, Ben. Is that, you know, that these components actually bring to bear?
It's important, and that's why, you know, when you had the conversation, you know, we turn it over to ETFs. You know, culture is not really a word that comes into play. Because you're not dealing with the culture of, you know, an active management team or the manager or the firm's history. What you really are looking at is kind of index construction and factor exposure. And ultimately, maybe that is the culture of, you know, an ETF's, you know, product lineup. You know, you see some that are kind of more, you know, smart beta oriented, some are more passive oriented, some are more multi-factor. So it is interesting. And then that's why I think, you know, if you look at some of these ETF models available on our research platform, is that while they might be, you know, let's say all size and style oriented or sector oriented, is that the index construction of those, the indexes that they're being used in those ETFs can, you know, sway and move the performance of those models, right? And I think that's what's unique too, is that, you know, if you compare, let's say, the State Street and iShares, you know, sector models on our platform, or you look at, let's say, you know, PowerShares and First Trust, which take a more, you know, smart beta or momentum or multi-factor oriented approach, you know, they will work at different times, they will act differently. And I think, it, to your point, is one reason, you know, why you might pair a PIMCO with an American funds or a passive with, you know, T. Rowe, is that you compare some of the models on our system, because, you know, or at least the ETF models, is that, you know, they might use a different approach when they develop their ETFs. They might go after different factors.
Sure.
Right? And so they might pair well together, which is why we do see some advisors, you know, use, you know, let's say one of our, you know, more focused sector models that takes kind of a more multi-factor focused approach with a more kind of passive index ETF approach with another provider.
Right, which leads to kind of part B of the story, which is, well, we've talked about shop culture and how to stay in the homogeneous nature of a shop, and I think you led it right back around to kind of my second most favorite, you know, which is, you know, find those unique, and let's say in this case ETFs, that matter. That bring something, you know, to the table. And sometimes that reminds me of Core Solution, where there's different providers involved. Core Solution is more of an S&P 500 dedicated portfolio, multi-provider in some sense. Guggenheim, iShares,
State Street,
you know. And
it's unique. And so Core Solution, you know, is a concept where you are targeting what? Kind of U.S. large cap, or really the core of the U.S. equity market?
Yeah. In other words, it goes with this theory that the S&P 500 stocks And as you know, they're updated yearly, and over the decades, they end up representing the most popular stocks in the economy. But the S&P 500 stocks as a group, in some form or in some weighting scheme, are the most important stocks on Earth. Or you could say globally are the starting point of a great investment game plan, is knowing what those stocks are doing and what form of those stocks seems more favorable. What does one mean by form? Well, you know, you know the S&P 500 index, as most commonly seen, is TV, whatever, newspaper, is more of a natural weighting scheme of the market, the cap-weighted, you know, weighting scheme of the market, where the biggest companies have the most exposure and weight. And, you know, one would say, you know, that's great, and that's the index. And pardon me, I did knock the mic there. and so there's that formation, and that could be in leadership at different times in history. There's the equal weighted format,
yep,
meaning that there's no everybody's got an equal vote. No one stock controls no 30 stocks control the preponderance of how the index moves, but it's an equal vote. And I think that there are many times, in fact, what we found, Ben, correct me if I'm wrong, but the equal weighted format's typically in control of the market more chronological time than a cap weighted format. I know some people will say, I don't believe that's true, but no, we've seen that to be the case, and of course we've measured that in history to be the case. And then there's the low vol, mm-hmm, formation. Explain low vol.
So low vol, one of the constituents within the inventory is the PowerShares S&P 500 low vol portfolio, and the idea is that it is basically an ETF that owns stocks of the S&P 500 with the lowest volatility, or the lowest, you know, historical realized volatility, you know, standard deviation essentially. And so low vol, you know, is a unique phenomenon in the sense that, you know, for so long it's been thought that in order to increase your return, you need to take more risk. Mm-hmm. Low vol basically takes an alternative approach that you can actually increase your return by taking low risk exposure to low volatility.
Right.
And so that market, or markets where we see low vol participating, typically you might see a classic, again, I hate, it's overused, but transition from, you know, risk on to risk off, where, mm-hmm, you know, investors are, let's say, looking for ways to take exposure to less riskier areas. They might go towards low volatility. Low volatility also acts to some extent like value, right? Mm-hmm. And has some characteristics like that. So we do see transitions where low vol, you know, can participate in utilities and consumer staples, financials, and at a greater extent than some other products. And so if those sectors are doing well, you can see low vol work well.
You just made a good point. I want to go back and walk on that one again. Low vol is constructed with low vol factors, meaning that when you buy it, it registered low vol.
Right.
Contrast that to maybe your favorite large value manager over the different decades and years that you recall, and check me if I'm not right, that there are many times in the market where your favorite large value manager is actually leaning pretty growthy,
yeah,
and is not behaving as classic large value, possibly having higher R risks, meaning relative risks or standard deviations or betas, than one would have expected, mm-hmm, because they thought it was the right time to, you know, to lean, what I call lean right, which is lean towards higher risk. And I think that's a great point, Ben. I mean, that's part of portfolio construction. The reason we don't have XYZ classic large cap, my favorite value manager in Core Solution, there's a reason for that. The reason we do have a scientifically built low vol, let's say value fund in there, is to make sure that when we need low volatility, that it actually is present. I think that's crucial. It's part of that inventory design, is that we are getting what we're paying for.
Right, and that's a brilliant point, and I think that's how we, you know, I like to talk about inventory construction. You know, we look at the ultimate outcome of these models is that, you know, the portfolio that is generated at any given point in time is reflecting, you know, kind of the strength and the opportunities within that inventory. And the point of that is that it's supposed to change and adjust going forward, is that we need to make sure that we have an inventory that can work in different types of market and different regimes. And so when you're developing a model, you need to make sure that you're going to have some stuff that will work today, that might work tomorrow, that might work back then, so we can navigate the future. And so if we look at the core solution model, to your point, is that you have, if you look at the traditional style boxes, or you look at the traditional risk factor metrics or return metrics, is that in markets that favor kind of a more defensive approach, you might have a low vol product in there.
Right.
In markets that favor value, you might see the Dow Jones potentially in there, you might see low vol in there. Markets that favor growth, you might see a momentum factor ETF in there, you might see a large growth ETF like the Qs in there. Markets that favor a broader approach, you might see the S&P 500, you might see RSP. Markets that favor kind of a more not mid-cap per se, but a smaller segment of the large-cap space, you might see RSP,
right?
Which is breadth, right?
Right.
And so that's the whole point. I think what's so unique about your core solution model is that, it has a diverse inventory, even though you're pulling from a small segment of the U.S. market.
Yeah. In fact, as you kind of check around, the idea is that the overwhelming percentage of those funds, and I don't want to restate the obvious, but sometimes you got to state it so we all know. Is at least a 92% weighting in the class, in the S&P 500 stocks as a mandate for each of those funds. In other words, we wouldn't wake up one day and any one of those funds is actually not dominated inside the S&P 500 stocks, and we find it elsewhere.
Right.
Because that would actually kind of negate the strategy we're trying to do. So, in other words, the inventory has limits and controls on it in that sense. Some people say, well, that's fair enough, but why is the Dow Jones in there? When has the Dow Jones ever been a leading index? And I think that, well, that's easy to say over the last 10 or maybe let's minus this year and minus next year and minus a few years ahead of us for fun. And let's just go back, 10, 15 years. You say, yeah, well, it's not the leadership index, but I'll tell you what it is. It has extremely high visibility. People know exactly what it is, what's in there. It's a great talking point. When classic, what I call, dominant value markets, it will respond. It will be there to help you, and we'll know what its constituents are. And I think it's a good. It's like what's an analogy, Ben? High school football, greatest tailback you got. Well, if you got a great tailback, why do you need a fullback?
Someone to block for you.
Right. You're right. And so think of the Dow Jones as a great fullback. Yeah. It's in there, and it's going to provide some help when we need it.
Yeah.
And without it, right, then things get unbalanced. Now we'd have no value component. We're biased to the growth side, and I think that we've got to consider that the Dow Jones is put in there meaningfully. I understand it's not the leadership index of the world. I understand it's not the racehorse. I don't know it won't be in the future. It has been in some pasts, but it serves a meaningful role.
Right. Yeah. I mean, your fullback might only get 2 carries a season.
Yeah.
Right. But he's been blocking for you all year.
They might be an important two.
Exactly. And so, I think that's what is unique about the models that are available on our research platform, as well as any of our index products, and also. What's unique about the tools that are available on the research platform, where you can construct your own model-based portfolio, is that definitely we take important consideration of making sure we have the right inventory, and we definitely recommend you doing the same. If you have any questions about kind of creating inventory, if you're doing some model testing on our website, or why some of the model returns might be different, right? Yes, it's been a strong market, but as you alluded to earlier, the T. Rowe Price model has behaved in a different fashion than some of the other models on the research platform. Why is that?
Sure.
And I think those are the type of questions that we try to answer in the Daily Equity Report and these podcasts, as well as any telephone call that we have with you, the advisor who gives us a call.
Right.
Well, thank you so much for tuning in. It was a different topic today, and I hope that you enjoyed it. We certainly like talking about it, because it's such an important part of what we do on a daily basis, is making sure that we're able to develop the right models that you can use for all your different clients. Well, thank you so much, and take care.
Thank you.